I'm Aditya Chakraborty. I'm the economics leader writer for The Guardian.
Clearly, you have to simplify and package issues for a non-specialist audience. So if you're asked to summarise the crisis for somebody who is economically illiterate, how would you define it?
To me, the heart of the banking crisis is about banks that got too big and were allowed too much sway over how they ran themselves and used that freedom to make some extremely dangerous choices which weren't then closely monitored by regulators. And in that process, they got bigger, they got more profitable, they kept on going, and in the end, things came to an end.
Is this a technical problem about banks growing too large, about markets malfunctioning?
Actually, I think it's largely a political question. We've never had this situation where banks have been so big and so unbeholden to government in whatever form, whether that's regulators, whether that's Bank of England, whether that's actually people sat in Whitehall. And there was a reason for that. The reason was that government thought that banks were better off running themselves, and government thought, let's not question what the banks are doing, because they can use the, we can use the tax revenues they give us for our own ends. We can use that to help the poor, for instance. The problem with that is that if you let a particular balloon grow too big, it ends up, you know, taking up the entire room.
I mean, it seems to me that your analysis is primarily political. This is, in a sense, the legacy of Thatcher and the absence of clear thinking by New Labour. Is that the problem?
I think that's largely right. I mean, I should say something about the way various newspapers and the media have tried to explain what happened. Ever since Northern Rock actually fell over in, you know, September 2007. There have been various explanations. One is that it's all to do with this money being made by China, which they can't find a home to invest. Another is that it's all to do with people everywhere around the Western world just loading up on debt. Another argument goes that it's all to do with these very complex products. What all of these explanations lack, it seems to me, is an explanation of why it is that the banks did this, and why it is that when banks fell over, it had such an impact on the economy, particularly the UK economy. And I think that is a political explanation. I think that is a result of choices made first by Thatcher, but then left unchecked and perhaps even encouraged by Tony Blair and Gordon Brown.
But if we complicate the story in this way and say it's not simply macro imbalances or consumers behaving irresponsibly, if we say it's political, doesn't that then mean it's very hard to figure out what you do next? I mean, what is the solution?
In one way, the solution in political terms, in simple, straightforward storytelling terms, is quite simple. The bank has got out of control, it's our job to rein in the bankers. That's one possible story you can tell. The problem is that all the other stories are far more seductive and far more straightforward, far more intuitive. So, oh, we all borrowed too much. Well, we all know the feeling of having spent too much and feeling a bit empty at the end. Oh, it's the Chinese. Well, that's good, because it's a foreign country, so they've produced all this money that we now have to sort of suffer through. But also, the problem with pinning it on the role of the banks and the excessive power of the banks is that you then come up quite hard against a formidable lobby. These banks, I mean, some of them are bigger than some of the economies that they were sat within. So how on earth do you rein them in?
If you follow through that problem and that analysis, don't you end up in the kind of situation we see in the American Senate at present, where the Obama administration's honourable intentions are being watered down by Democratic and Republican senators, all of whom are beholden to financial contributions?
I think that's right in American context, but you can hear much of the same language, but in slightly more rarefied British terms over here. You hear an awful lot from, say, Boris Johnson, Mayor of London, who says, well, you know, we should not be clamping down on one of our major money-making industries. It's one of our comparative advantages. He uses that sort of language. He's not alone. A lot of MPs, both on front bench and back bench, will say that. These were sentiments they couldn't barefacedly say 2 years ago, but they've got no problem saying that in 2010.
Is it therefore the case that this is politically unfixable, that we have in a sense created a kind of political lobby, a political interest, which actually is going to prevent the restraint of banking?
I suppose taking on a formidable lobby is always going to be an immense job of work. I think there are two things that were noticeably lacking during this banking crisis, which would have made that job easier. One was we could have had more of a kind of academia or intellectual force which would have been more inclined to interrogate the claims of the banking industry. We did that wasn't really there, with certain honourable exceptions. You didn't get an awful lot of academics coming out and saying, well, what's gone wrong? Let's really go through this at high speed. A lot of the academia, people in academia, a lot of intellectuals, they were quite inclined to take whatever explanations being, you know, offered to them, which would be about macro imbalances or whatever. So that's one thing. So the intellectuals basically were missing from the battlefield. But the other thing that you really noticed during this crisis was that there was not a political party that was willing to take the fight to the bankers. You had two species of argument for what went wrong. On the conservative side of things, it was about people loading up on too much debt, whether that's everything from a kid going to buy trainers to Gordon Brown. But on the Labour side of things, there was no kind of countervailing argument about, well, hold on, the bankers are the ones who've landed us in recession. We need to think about how to take punitive measures on the bankers and also how to restructure the economy, crucially, how to restructure the economy so that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. That language is completely missing from the Labour Party. So you lacked kind of intellectual theme tune, but you also lacked a sort of political party that was willing to take this fight.
Is that a kind of structural characteristic of post-Thatcherite politics? Mrs. Thatcher's great success was she shifted the terrain of politics so that the organised working class need no longer be taken seriously.
I don't think so, but that's because I'm an optimist. You could have a coalition of interest between the middle class who don't work in finance typically, and certainly don't work in Goldman Sachs or Citigroup or any of these sorts of, you know, glittering palaces in Canary Wharf. You could have a coalition between the middle classes who might work in the public sector, for instance, and the working classes. And that's something that we saw hold New Labour in power for 13 years.
Could I follow that up? Because it's now very interesting. We've got clearly a situation domestically where the unpleasantness of the crisis has been postponed, not prevented. And as the public expenditure cuts come through, it's going to look very unpleasant for lots of people, particularly, you know, the third or so of the workforce who are dependent on the public sector and public expenditure. But if we look at that, where do you think the economy is going economically, and what are the political implications of that for the coalition?
I think there are two answers to that. One is a straightforward, boring economic analysis. You say, what are the four main sources of national income, as economists term? One is exports. Well, we've had a 30% drop in the value of the pound, and there's been no export boom. I mean, unbelievable. Secondly is government spending. Well, we know that the Tories aren't interested in carrying on with the sort of high levels of government spending that we saw under Labour in the crisis. The third is to have business investment. Well, I see no signs of business investment anywhere. And finally, there's consumption, shopping. And what we're going to have is a VAT, a high rate of VAT brought in January, but also a great deal more worry about job losses. So I would say, just on a straightforward sort of looking at the four main legs of any economy, three out of four of them are gone, and the other one looks pretty shaky. That's pretty worrying. I can see this talk of double-dip recession. I can see that coming
in.
Do
you actually think it's, if you take that basically Keynesian macro kind of approach to the trajectory of the economy, do you think we're heading for a double-dip recession or for a wasted decade on the Japanese pattern after the end of the Heisei boom?
The two aren't exclusive. I mean, Japan had a number of times in which it tried to get out of recession and then slipped back in. And there are lots of times in the Japanese economy, especially with deflation, where they might as well have been in technical recession anyway. I certainly see that if we stick to the kind of contractionary policies that we've got at the moment, where it is about cutting government spending in the absence of any other force to lift the economy forward, I certainly see that we could be spending a lot of years down a cul-de-sac marked zero growth.
So how does that play politically?
Well, there are two ways you could see this. One is a kind of if you're sat in Downing Street at the moment and you're a Conservative advisor, your great hope is that somehow people will bear with this story of everything having been terrible beforehand, before you. So Gordon Brown made it all terrible, and what you have to do is go through this lengthy process of sweeping up, which everyone accepts will be messy and painful and take time. But politically, it's not ruinous for Conservatives. And in the meantime, what they sincerely hope is that exports, business investment, all the rest of that stuff will pick up. But there's another way of seeing all of this happening, which is actually growth doesn't come along because the rest of the world is doing pretty much the same, well, especially in Europe, which is our major trading partner, they're doing the same sort of things as we are. So what do the Conservatives do? Well, they come up with an account for what's going on, which relies upon picking losers, if you like, and they ring-fence certain victims, the people who work in the public sector, perhaps, certainly people who receive welfare, and they say these are the two groups that are going to get it harder than everyone else. And the rest of the electorate is so distracted by looking at the beatings being given to public sector workers and people living on disabled living allowance, for instance, they don't notice that their own standard of living is taking a severe drop.
It seems to me, essentially, they have to repeat the achievements of Mrs. Thatcher, which first were to convince people that it was complete chaos beforehand, you know, the bin bags in the streets, the three-day week, all the rest of that kind of business. And then they have to find a minority, in the Thatcherite case, the industrial working class. Surely that's not going to work, because one of the problems is that, you know, it kind of did work for those who benefited from the public sector boom under Brown and Blair, and you know, the Brits generally approved of the expansion of health and education expenditure, and that was widely dispersed across the economy.
But there are two responses to that, Carol. One is that you simply say it's not unknown for classes to vote to support things which aren't in their own interest. I mean, it's one of the classic problems that we always deal with in whatever part of economic analysis we work in. But secondly, and more importantly, is think about how this plays out in politics. You need then a party that will say, actually, we stand behind all these things about the expansion of the public sector. We stand behind having a reasonable degree of welfare provision. At the moment, we don't have that in the Labour Party. We don't have that in Liberal Democrats because they are junior coalition partners. Also think about this. We could get to the stage where by 2013, a lot of the welfare state has been scaled back because they don't want to, because the rhetoric will be, we should be providing support for people who most need it, which means effectively taking away the universal principle and depriving the middle classes of it. Now, let's say you have a Labour Party which comes back to its senses and says, actually, we really want tax credits for children and people who are living on £30,000 a year, they deserve tax credits too. By that stage, George Osborne and David Cameron have got a very simple question to put to them, which is, how are you going to pay for that? And so going into the next election, 2015, if things carry on as they are, which is a big assumption, I grant you, but if things carry on as they are, at 2015, you could easily see Labour's tax bombshell. They want to pay for these wasteful tax credits, and how are they going to do that? By hitting you with more taxes.
So you're very pessimistic about the political, about the dynamics of politics going forward. I mean, one of the implications of your analysis is that, in a sense, the great white hope, or we shouldn't say great white hope any longer, should we? But the great hope going forward is that Labour, as you put it, comes to its senses. But even if Labour comes to its senses, it's got a very difficult pitch to sell to the electorate.
I think that is right, but there is one sort of big factor for optimism, which is New Labour was sustained by a coalition of interest between working classes, what was left of them, and the middle classes. And at the moment, what the Tories are trying to do, and you saw quite a lot of this in the budget, George Osborne's project is to split part two, and to say that the working classes deserve certain tax credits, the middle classes don't, therefore the middle classes are free from the welfare state, but also say the middle classes can be split between those in the private sector and those in the public sector, and those in the public sector get taken away to one side. So he's trying to break up that coalition. But that coalition is there for the time being.
The question then, I suppose, is think of the Labour leadership contenders. How many of them are capable of moving towards your kind of analysis? And in a sense, the implication of your political analysis is you need another Tony Blair, discredited as he is, somebody who's capable of putting together a cross-class coalition and inventing some kind of language which makes it appear meaningful?
Far be it from me to say that we need the ghost of Tony Blair to return. I think you certainly do need someone who can take the fight to the Tories. But I don't think that necessarily means that you therefore have to subscribe to all the values and beliefs that the Tories are putting around and compromise with them, hedge around them and all the rest of that. I think there is an argument to be had. And you see this in the opinion polls where people are wary about the Tories. They're not sure they're doing the right thing. They're certainly wary about tax rises, but they're also not sure about spending cuts either. And as the reality of spending cuts, you know, is felt, I think that sort of coalition, I think, might actually end up being tighter rather than looser.
Another aspect of the whole thing is the disorder and the disorganisation at an international and supranational level. The old story was, you know, everybody had bailed out the banks and concerted international action would save capitalism. Now at the G20, they're all at sixes and sevens and Europe is pro-deflation. How do you think the international thing complicates things?
I think there are two stories going on. One is that back in 2008, it was far easier to identify an existential threat and to call it banking. And that served a number of different purposes. For America and Britain, it was about propping up banks and rescuing capitalism. To some extent, Nicolas Sarkozy in France, Angela Merkel in Germany, they scrubbed some of that. But for them, it was also a case of, well, let's batten down the hatches on Anglo-Saxon capitalism. This is our big opportunity. So Nicolas Sarkozy could talk about what he was doing to prop up banks, but he could also say, and never again will we have this kind of mad Anglo-Saxon capitalism stalking across Europe. Come forward to 2010, and what we're talking about now is not about finance. I mean, it's quite noticeable how little discussion there was about banking at the summit in Toronto this year. What they're talking about now is debt. And there, you do tend to get two very clearly divergent opinions. Remember, Keynes worked in Cambridge and Bloomsbury. He didn't live and work in Bavaria or Berlin. The Germans were never that persuaded by the idea of reflating the economy. They've spent a decade actually doing the opposite of that. For them to carry on deflating their economy, to carry on depressing living standards for German workers, that's fine for them. They'll just carry on doing that. They'll certainly carry on doing that, and they'll be damned if they're going to pay for people in southern Europe to reflate their economy.
I mean, of course, this is tied up not only with debt, which is being discussed, but also with trade flows and all the rest of it. I mean, the Germans are massively reflating their economy through their success in manufacturing exports.
That is right. They have that ability to have an export-led recovery. I think that's also short-term, though, because you can't carry on having an export-led recovery if there's no one left for you to export to. If everyone else is taking a dive, there isn't that much in the way of markets for you.
But one of the implications of all this is that the European ideal, the European project, is going to take a back seat over the next 5-10 years, because quite clearly national differences are going to be quite marked.
I think the European project has been on the back foot ever since the financial crisis came along. If you go back just 4 years or so, people were talking about, well, what should Europe look like? Should it be wider? Should it be deeper? You don't hear that language anymore. And I think the reason for that is that at the first big test for the Eurozone, it failed. The financial crisis came along. It was revealed that this great open capital market that the Europeans created didn't even have a single capital market regulator. There were just various regulators across the various different countries. There was a patchwork of regulation. When it came to trying to coordinate efforts to rescue banks or to coordinate efforts to reflate the economies in 2008, well, there was a clear divergence there as well. So I think the European project is under existential threat. I think the arguments over Greece have given you a glimpse of how the European project might end, which is with a big squabble over a southern European country which desperately needs funds, which Germans are determined they won't get.
To a group which has actually profited from the crisis, namely the central bankers. One might have thought that they would have been discredited by it all, but if we look at the Fed or the Bank of England, their powers are augmented. The only people who've done really well out of the crisis have been the central bankers. Should we have some misgivings about that?
My God. Just go back to 2007. Mervyn King was in charge of the Bank of England. The story, the gossip, I can't confirm this, but there is, I've heard this more than once, that Mervyn King, before the financial crisis hit Britain, he used to have read to him something called a financial stability report, and he used to get information what was going on in the city. And he would take these opportunities as an interlude for him to sleep. So someone would be reading to him the financial stability report, he would nod off. The financial crisis came along, and even while we had scenes of downtown Buenos Aires with people queuing up outside a bank to get their deposit money out, he was still talking about high table arcana like moral hazard. He was very, very slow in spotting the recession coming until it was almost too late. And now he's in a position where the Conservatives will refer every single decision they've made to, well, Mervyn says it's okay. And now he's in charge of regulating the entire city yet again.
Yes, so the most depressing thing of all is that Bernanke and King are still in charge.
I think Bernanke is a different character, but let's take Bernanke out of the equation. Imagine you get someone like Greenspan back in charge. I mean, Greenspan and King, can you imagine a worse combination?